Thank you so much for coming this morning. I want to welcome you on behalf of the Commonwealth Club and the Center for International Policy. This morning's discussion, we're going to focus on the Obama administration's new rules authorizing academic and people-to-people educational and cultural travel to Cuba. I'm Christina Namath, the travel director for the Commonwealth Club of California. For those of you that live in San Francisco, you may be familiar with the Commonwealth Club. For those of you that don't, the Commonwealth Club is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum. We have programs in San Francisco, the South Bay, and the East Bay, about 400 programs a year on topics of current events, politics, history, arts, and culture. I welcome you all to grab one of our magazines on your way out and learn more about the organization. I want to thank our speakers for traveling out from the East Coast and joining us this morning, Wayne Smith and Elizabeth Newhouse from the Center of International Policy and attorney Robert Muse. I'm extremely pleased to be co-hosting these meetings with the Center and support their mission of promoting U.S. foreign policy based on international cooperation, demilitarization, and respect for human rights. I encourage you all to visit the CIP website to learn about their history and work around the world. Again, thank you all for coming today and to dedicating some part of your day to these meetings. Most of us here chose to pursue work centered around travel in one way or another, and I would assume that it is because we have all experienced the transformative power of travel in our own lives. Through our work, we aim to promote understanding and meaningful exchange between the world's people, and I thank you for joining us as we work towards more exchange between the people of the United States and the people of Cuba. The goals for today's sessions are to explain the new White House regulations on travel to Cuba, to suggest types of itineraries that are likely to be approved for licenses, and to promote people-to-people Cuba travel as a means of engaging with the Cuban people and helping put U.S.-Cuba relations on a path to normalization. Our first speaker today is a man with a long history working in and with Cuba. Dr. Wayne Smith is the director of the Cuba Program and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. He is also a visiting professor of Latin American Studies at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Wayne first began observing the Cuban Revolution as an analyst in the Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research in early 1957, just after Castro returned to Cuba to begin his guerrilla struggle against Batista. He was then transferred to Havana, arriving there in August of 1958, and remaining as the third Secretary of Political Affairs until the U.S. broke diplomatic relations in January of 1961. He served on the Cuba desk from 1964 to 66 and was with the first group of American diplomats to return to Cuba in 1977. From 1977 until 79, he was Director of Cuba Affairs in the Department of State and then became chief of the U.S. interest sections in Havana until 1982. He is a former senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of The Closest of Enemies, A Personal and Diplomatic History of the Castro Years. He has been with the Center for International Policy's Cuba program since 1992. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Wayne Smith.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me. She has said that I was third secretary of embassy from 1958 until we broke relations in January of 1961. As you've probably all noticed, the Cubans are now celebrating their victory over us at what we call the Bay of Pigs, what they call Playa Girón. It was 50 years ago. Special meaning for me, let me say. We broke relations in January the 3rd of 1961, returned to Washington. Most of the members of the embassy staff were immediately assigned to other posts. But I and a few others were kept in Washington For reasons we didn't quite understand, they had me writing a little daily report nobody ever read. It was obviously make work. So I was thinking, why are they keeping us here? And I finally got the nerve to confront or to ask the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs directly, are you keeping us here to send in after the supposedly victorious invasion that we all know is coming? And he refused to answer. Well, that was my answer. Yes, that's what they were doing. We were being kept to go in behind the victorious invaders and be the new embassy staff. Needless to say, I didn't return to Havana under those circumstances. So after a few months, I was transferred to Brazil. But, you know, how embarrassing. The Bay of Pigs, or Playa Girón, you land 1,200 guys against a regular army of 60,000, backed with 100,000 militia. How do you possibly, even, you know, said, well, Kennedy canceled the airstrikes. So what? The airstrikes wouldn't have made that much of a difference. It's just, I was convinced that the CIA, the people planning this, thought that this was going to be just as easy as overthrowing Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. Well, it's very different. The Guatemalan army didn't have a very high regard for Arbenz and didn't want to fight for him. That was certainly not true of the new Cuban army. After the Cuban Revolution, they would fight and did fight, and we should have known that. And if anyone had asked some of the people coming out of the embassy, we would have told them so, but no one did. Anyway, it was a colossal failure. And the Cubans are now celebrating it, but respectful may not be the word, but they're not exactly gloating and shouting. They won, yes, but that was 50 years ago, and they face lots of new problems today. So they are celebrating their victory at the Bay of Pigs and Castro's declaration of a socialist country, because it was the night before the Bay of Pigs that Castro, for the first time, declared that Cuba was a socialist country. For obvious reasons, he knew the invasion was coming, and he probably didn't think it was going to be with 1,200 guys. He probably thought it was with the 1st and 2nd Marine Divisions and 82nd and 101st Airborne. No, it wasn't, and so he won. But his idea was, if the Americans have decided that they're going to come after me with force, then I am going to need the support of the Soviet Union. And the only way, he thought, of really assuring that was to declare Cuba to be a socialist country. And so he did. It wasn't a socialist country, but he then began to transform it, and it did so become. In the process, of course, the Soviets decided they would place missiles in Cuba. Thank goodness that turned out well. Both Kennedy and Khrushchev, I think, responded in a sensible way to this crisis, in a sense created by both, more by Khrushchev. But let me just add here, sort of, I felt at the time slightly reassured. I was embarrassed by the Bay of Pigs. I mean, how could we have been that dumb, you know, to send in 1,200 guys against 60,000? And it failed miserably, as of course it did. It had to fail. How could we have been so dumb? Well, then a year later, you have Khrushchev putting in missiles. He's going to put missiles in Cuba. Castro agrees, but says we should do it openly. We can't get them in secretly. The Americans will be on to it. We should do it openly. Let's sign a new mutual defense agreement and indicate that the missiles are coming in as part of that agreement. If the Americans don't like it, well, they can negotiate and maybe get their missiles out of Turkey, which was one of the things that had brought Khrushchev to decide to put the missiles into Cuba. And Castro was absolutely right, but Khrushchev said, no, we must do it secretly. Well, you couldn't do it secretly. We had U-2s overhead, if not every day, frequently. They could see what was going on down there. Of course they could. At a conference later, we asked Castro, why did you go along with this decision on Khrushchev's part to put them in secretly when you knew it couldn't be done? And he said, well, he was the elder statesman. I had to sort of go along at that point. It's an answer. It's not maybe a satisfactory one, but anyway, it made me feel better. Yes, we had behaved stupidly at the Bay of Pigs, and Khrushchev behaved stupidly with the missiles. No way you were going to get them in secretly, and of course we had the missile crisis resulted from that. But thank goodness, as I was saying, thank goodness Khrushchev and Kennedy were sensible when it came to settling it. Now, all that is behind us. They are celebrating the victory and the declaration of Cuba as a socialist state. But at the same time, in this Congress that they have called and they now begins, they are indicating that they are going to move away from the strict confines of Marxism-Leninism. They've already started giving land, I mean, not title, but use of land to private individuals, to farmers. Interesting that has not resulted so far in any increase in agricultural production. It's mighty hot out there, and it's hard working in those fields. So if the land is turned over to the individual tiller, there may be a tendency on his part not to get out there every morning at the crack of dawn. We'll see how that works. But they are moving in this direction, leaving it more up to the individual agriculturalist as to how the farm is worked, rather than in the old days as, a state farm, you have a director and people work for a salary. They didn't think that worked very well. I agree. Let's see how much better this works and how much more quickly, how fast it begins to develop. Also in terms of some businesses, there's a greater openness now to private businesses. So they're moving in the direction of a more flexible system. I think that's all to the good. But much depends on how they work it and how they pay for it. Now, I'm encouraged by the fact that the Obama administration has lifted restrictions on Cuban American remittances to Cuba. Cuban Americans can send as much money as they want to family members in Cuba. And even here recently, the Obama administration has lifted restrictions on remittances from American citizens to Cuban citizens. This hopefully will open the way to some extent. This is not the solution, but will open the way to some extent for businesses to begin, that Cuban-American families will send money to their relatives down there to open small businesses, and that can be very, very helpful. I don't say that that will be the key, that will make everything work, but it certainly will help. Now, what about academic travel? Here again, the Obama administration has opened up to academic travel. You know, I was the director of the Cuba Exchange Program at Johns Hopkins for a number of years. And it was very successful. We brought up Cuban scholars. We could do that then. We brought up Cuban academics to spend 3 months at Johns Hopkins, and we took Hopkins students to Cuba. We did not, as some universities did. Some universities would have a course on Cuba or a course on U.S.-Cuban relations, and they would take their students to Cuba maybe for 2 or 3 weeks as part of that course. So they did get credit, but they didn't do the whole thing in Cuba by any means. We did it in a slightly different way. We would take students down between sessions or between semesters. Usually in January, we would take them down for 2 to 3 weeks to study some aspect of Cuban culture, Cuban theater, Cuban dance, history, various aspects of Cuban politics, foreign relations, and so forth. They would go down for 2.5 to 3 weeks and get full credit for that. And it worked very well. I think the academic exchange program was very useful in helping to bring our two peoples together. Didn't solve all the problems by any means, but it was very useful. Then along comes George Bush, of course, and he wipes it all out. No more Cubans coming up for visits to the no more Cuban academics coming up for a visit to the United States, and most of the courses were wiped out in 2004 by his edict. So a few universities were able to keep going, keep their exchange programs with Cuba going. We were not. So ours ended, our exchange program was ended, for all practical purposes, in 2004. We are now moving to resuscitate an academic exchange program, and I think it will be as successful now as it was then, with one exception. We still can't, at this point, in any event, we still can't invite up Cuban academics to spend 3 months or 4 months or whatever it is with us at Johns Hopkins. I hope that will come, but so far has not. It seems to me so obvious that these academic contacts, academic exchange programs, are really a key to bringing about better understanding between Cuba and the United States. And I found, and still find, that Cuban academics are perfectly open. They're willing to engage in a very sensible way, no shouting and screaming, anything of the sort. Esteban Morales has been sort of the key to all this for years and still is, and he'll be up this month, and we'll participate in a conference we're going to do June the 2nd. Anyway, the guidelines are perhaps not yet fully clear, but if you want to do an academic exchange program with Cuba, you can certainly do so. I mean, you know, get in contact with someone involved in international relations at the University of Havana. There are all kinds of ways to go about it, and I'm sure you're all in contact with providers, with travel providers. So I think it's very important that these academic exchanges resume and are successful. And I think if they do resume, well, they are resuming, and they will be successful. I don't see any doubt about that. I'm not the one to talk about the legalities of all this, so I will, let's see, we're turning the floor over to you, Bob. Is that,
I think,
okay, Elizabeth first.
People,
yeah, okay, well, Elizabeth will talk about people to people. Let me say the academic exchanges are one thing, and people to people, of course, is something else. It was that way under the Clinton administration. We had academic exchanges, the sort that we had at Johns Hopkins, but then you had what the Clinton administration called people-to-people, where you could get a group together and they wanted to go down and look at Cuban art, Cuban ballet, some aspect of Cuban culture, and you'd take the group down and they would be there for a period of time. It was really great and lots of fun. So now we're going to do that again. We're opening up to people to people exchanges, and Elizabeth will tell you about those. Elizabeth.
Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Newhouse, former travel book publisher at National Geographic. I helped plan their Cuba trips nearly a decade, I guess more than a decade ago when they were possible, and I also served as the so-called expert lecturer on a number of their trips, including the first one. My friend and author Christopher Baker is here in the room. I think he also went as lecturer on National Geographic trips. In any case, he has written more books about Cuba than anyone I know, and he knows every corner of the island probably better than anyone alive. I realize many others here have organized trips to Cuba too and know what an enticing and interesting and unique place it is. How much they want to do it again once these people-to-people trips get going. But for those who don't know it, I'm going to do a quick rundown of the National Geographic tours and what Cuba travel offers. In 2001 and 2, National Geographic organized 8 trips to Cuba a year. Their expeditions tour program, which is today very large and successful, had just launched, so this was a very large number of trips to one place in a single year. And they proved to be some of the most popular, successful, and profitable trips the Geographic has done. Needless to say, they cannot wait to get them started again. Participants were by and large sophisticated travelers who had covered the globe, and I know that they felt that their Cuba trip was among the best that they had ever been on. This was partly because for most of them, Cuba was such a surprise and such a revelation. Few knew that this small island nation, so close to Florida, had such a rich and outsized culture, that the capital city, Havana, was once the elegant, worldly, and exuberant Paris of the Western Hemisphere, that it was one of the world's great cities, closely entwined with the United States for much of a century and a half. But since 1959, except for a few moments during the Cold War, a few dramatic moments, I should say, policies and politics have pretty much isolated Cuba, putting it generally off the radar of all but a very small percentage of Americans. It's little wonder, then, that trips to Cuba are so popular among the American travel cognoscenti. This is adventure travel close to home, a forbidden communist country just a short hop from 21st century Miami, with a look that takes you back decades and is hardly changed. It really is an out-of-time experience. These reasons alone make it irresistible to many people, but there's much, much more. The richness and depth of its culture and history surpass anything else in the Caribbean. Its Afro-Cuban music, expressing Cuban sensuality, machismo, and intense joy in life, has been renowned since the 1930s. Dance is in the Cuban soul. The dynamic Cuban art scene is well known internationally. And there's a vibrant literary tradition. Many Cuban writers rank among the best of 20th century in the 20th century Spanish world. Havana's architecture is staggering, as anyone who's been there knows. Both in range and quality, its colonial core, the largest in the Western Hemisphere, spans 242 city blocks. But that's only the beginning. It also has a greater array of 20th century architecture than any city in the world, except for New York. The architecture, of course, ranges from Art Nouveau to modernism. The buildings alone are worth a visit. They really express most poignantly what a glittering city Havana once was. And Cuba's built environment is matched by the beauty of its landscapes. It's a veritable tropical Eden with a wide variety of endemic and rare plants and animals, and alone in the Caribbean, pristine coral reefs. And all this is just 90 miles from the United States. A decade ago, the National Geographic itineraries could encompass all of these sites and experiences and more. People-to-people licenses were approved by OFAC based on a model itinerary, which could be fairly wide-ranging. Licenses were good for multiple trips over a year. This time, as Robert Muse will tell you, political constraints may demand itineraries be approved individually and that they adhere to a single educational theme. That will be a shame if so, as it will limit the option for many Americans to broadly experience Cuba, as the Geographic and other such organizations back then were able to make possible. These Geographic trips went from one end of the island to the other. The itineraries included not only Havana, but also Santiago, the second, much more Caribbean city in the mountainous east, which I urge you to include in your trips, if at all possible. This is where you find the real Cubanismo, the place where all the revolutions began, the childhood home of the Castro brothers, of course, San Juan Hill, and where many of the battles of the 1950s were fought. It's also the birthplace of Cuban music. The Afro-Cuban spiritism that is so prevalent throughout Cuban society, giving it its aura of illusion and mystery, is greatly pronounced here. Between the two cities, the Geographic itineraries also included a visit to a former rich sugar mill in the former rich sugar-growing areas of central Cuba, and to the colonial cities of Trinidad, founded in the 16th century with its vivid pastel houses and cobblestone streets, and the prosperous sugar port of Cienfuegos with its French-themed architecture. Nearby, we'd visit the famous Bay of Pigs, site of the U.S. invasion 50 years ago yesterday, and as Wayne pointed out, our greatest gift to Fidel Castro's revolution. And also the Cienega de Zapata, the largest wetland ecosystem in the Caribbean, mirroring the Everglades, which protects hundreds and hundreds of rare birds and other creatures. The final stop we would make would be west of Havana in the lush tobacco-growing area. There is a 60,000-acre UNESCO biosphere reserve and Viñales, one of Earth's stunning valleys, with surreal dome-shaped limestone formations covered in vibrant green and deep caverns that snake for miles underground, obviously. To add to the pleasures of visiting Cuba are the Cubans themselves. For reasons no one can fully understand, given our 50 years of poisonous relations, preceded by more than 50 years of mostly self-interested U.S. domination, Cubans very much like and welcome Americans. As people, Cubans seem to have a natural affinity with us. Many people think it's more so than with their fellow Latin Americans even. They are industrious and entrepreneurial, highly resourceful, much less prone to siestas and the mañana attitude. Their capacity for survival, for getting along, for, as they call it, inventando, to manage the deep deprivations of their system, are highly, highly impressive. And many Cubans have family connections here, as you know. If our politics are light years apart, there is no denying our kinship. a frequent visitor from Los Angeles, says, when I'm in Mexico, I do everything possible to disguise the fact that I'm American. When I'm in Cuba, I make sure everyone knows it. Americans also need to know how close we've been historically. President Jefferson in 1808 made the first attempt to purchase, the first of many attempts to buy or annex the island. It's very likely someday we'll be close again. We hope in a much healthier relationship with mutual benefits that benefits both sides. There's much we can offer and learn from each other. Cubans are highly educated. They long to unleash their talents, and of course, one day they will. Meanwhile, we must get to know each other, and sending many Americans down on people-to-people trips is the very best way to start. Thank you.
Shall I?
Go ahead. Start?
I suppose it's on.
Let me just add that Elizabeth was, in a sense, raised in Cuba. She went to school there as a young girl, and she knows it very, very well.
I do. Not as well as Chris.
Clearly. I'm going to talk about the legal dimension to travel to Cuba and try to situate it within a context of individuals and institutions traveling to Cuba without subterfuge or without manipulations of existing programs. Unfortunately, that has been forced on many people who want to go to Cuba. At the moment, for example, research delegations are popular. Religious travel is popular. These are various ways that you can go to Cuba. But each of them, and most typically, there's an underlying misrepresentation in it. And that, for example, if you take a group, a cultural group to Cuba, a museum society, a foreign policy institute, they're members, and claim, you can do this. You can claim it's for religious purposes, and that's why you're there. At the moment, we're in a period broadly of non-enforcement of the travel ban under the Obama administration. But that can always change, and we've seen it change before. And the problem for reputable institutions or established institutions is the statute of limitations on violations of the travel ban reaches back for 6 years. So if you picture conceivably, the Republicans take over the Senate in 2012, they retain the House, and even a Republican president, you could see the embargo suddenly being enforced again. And that's what institutions are fearful of and what their lawyer and why their lawyers will hesitate to involve themselves in religious programs and things like that. The downside is heavy. Institutional penalties can be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. There are reputational issues for institutions in being prosecuted by the federal government. And there can be individual prosecutions, particularly if there's a profit motive in arranging the travel. So what's most hopeful in this context would be a return to people-to-people travel, instituted originally by the Clinton administration in 1999, and that does allow a broad array of alumni societies, museums, the lists are almost music societies, fine arts societies, to organize programs to Cuba for profit. They can market them to members of the association or the public at large. They can arrange a delegation to Cuba of as many as they can accommodate reasonably within the mission of the travel, for example, Cuban dance and music, Cuban fine art. They can decide what is the optimum number they want to take, 20 to 30 people. They can book accommodation. I'll return later to something called a travel service provider, but they can book accommodation. They can make all arrangements for ground transportation in Cuba and do their trip to Cuba in a way that's no different from a trip they might arrange to Florence or something like that. So that's the hope and promise of people-to-people travel. In January, the Obama administration announced it was reinstituting people-to-people travel. It's now whatever, it's been 4 months, I guess, and we're still waiting for the first thing, is a set of guidelines as that would give some particularized, detailed instructions about how to submit an application, what to, ought to be in the application, and so on. When the guidelines are, I'll return to the political context in a moment, because everything to do with Cuba is deeply political. And, well, why don't I just pause there for a moment and talk about the fact that Cuba is the only existing country in the world in which you're prohibited from traveling to. You can go to North Korea, you can go to Iran, you can go to Burma. There are many reasons for that that have to do with electoral politics, the significance of Florida and the presidential elections, some very artful campaign contributions that have brought Congress into supporting the embargo. So you're always going to be buffeted by political winds and anything to do with Cuba, uniquely so. So when President Obama announced the resumption of people-to-people travel in January, we were hopeful it would proceed seamlessly into execution. So far it hasn't, but I think it will. At the moment, we seem to be hung up over the arrest and 15-year imprisonment term given to a USAID contractor named Alan Gross. I'm hopeful that will be resolved and we'll go forward with the programs. There are, in thinking about people-to-people programs, and I'll return to a specific treatment of academic and people-to-people travel. Remember, people-to-people travel is going to be a political battleground. That's going to carry on. No sooner had the White House announced they were resuming people-to-people travel than a prominent Democratic senator from New Jersey, Menendez, says, vowed, we will fight this. And he then got an assistant secretary for Latin America to testify before the Foreign Relations Committee and ask him specifically. He held up a brochure of a group in San Diego that were promoting travel to Cuba for dance lessons. Doesn't fit into any existing category, but it's a kind of free fire zone right now. Everybody seems to be going to Cuba under some kind of program. He held up the promotion for the dance lessons and asked the assistant secretary, Valenzuela, would you support this sort of thing, people going to Cuba under people-to-people for dance lessons? Valenzuela gratuitously and true to form, no, I don't think so. I don't think we would approve that. A needless concession that Cuban dance forms or some of the vernacular dance forms is probably the single most powerful national expression in everything from, Elizabeth will know, mambo, I suppose, cha-cha-cha, all these different forms. What better? What? Well, she'll tell you more about it later. I can't dance. But anyway, there's no
Fidel Castro.
And that's one of the famous sayings about Fidel. He's the only Cuban who can't dance. But he's a Gallego, so there's a reason for it. But what better way to study the richness of the Cuban dance forms than to actually learn a Cuban dance? So a serious vision of people-to-people travel will allow that. And that's what the struggle is over at the moment in Washington that we all participate in. San Francisco uniquely has challenged the travel ban repeatedly in litigation. There are groups in San Francisco that have imaginatively, consistently pushed the boundaries of travel and even taken it into realms of civil disobedience to express their... So San Francisco is a very interesting place to talk about travel to Cuba, because it's a place that has fought longer and harder for that inherent right of citizenship than any other locale I know in the country. So on deal with academic travel, could you tell me how many people here are from academic institutions approximately? Okay. And the rest are principally interested in people-to-people travel? Yeah. So we'll go through academic travel. And we have a question and answer session, so we can always come back. And I'll fill in elements of professors that may wish to go to Cuba. What I'm going to principally deal with are undergraduates and programs for undergraduates in Cuba. A little bit of history. And the academic programs in Cuba of U.S. colleges and universities, there were about 200 of them that held licenses. Most of them weren't using the licenses. They were quite often find it economically unviable to set up their own program in Cuba. They may have half a dozen students that might want to spend, do a course in Cuba. So quite often, their students would enroll in another institution's program in Cuba. That was the situation until 2004. The Bush administration, again, everything's political, coming up on the reelection campaign in 2004, prominent Cuban-American embargo supporters complained that the Bush administration hadn't been forceful enough in its Cuba policies. Well, you know, they had other things on their plate at that point, Afghanistan and Iraq and everything else. So, but anyway, given the significance of Florida in the 2000 election, you know, whatever it was, in the end, a few hundred votes, they began to mutiny and say, well, if this president's not going to get serious about bringing the hammer down on Cuba, we might as well vote Democrat next time. Panic in the White House. So they established a presidential commission. What's the expression? Personnel equal policy. Mel Martinez, a hard right senator, Cuban-American senator from Florida, ended up chairing the commission, and it came back and abolished people-to-people travel formally, but put restrictions on academic travel that have now been removed. The restrictions were to all programs had to be of 10 weeks or more duration. As Wayne can tell you, as Johns Hopkins program, the most popular programs were usually 2 or 3 weeks in duration, intersessional between semesters. They're back. You can do this now. So about 200 institutions had specific licenses in the name of the institution. They applied, gave descriptions of the program they intended to introduce in Cuba, and they would get a license, good for 1 or 2 years. The Obama rules are heartening on academic travel because they are an affirmation of academic freedom. The new rule is it's a general license. You don't have to write to anybody. You don't have to get permission to do it. You are a general license means you're authorized to do it by law. There are some compliance issues I'll address in a moment. So if you're a college or university and you want to do a program in Cuba, it can be of 1 week duration, 2 weeks, or a full semester. Think about what your student needs would be, and many of you have rich experience of this, and through your colleagues and organizations like the Latin American Studies Association, can find good models of academic programs in Cuba, or ask Wayne. He's done them on themes like Cuban health care. What are some other thematic topics that you've
Dance, culture.
So it could be political systems of Cuba, history of Cuba, language of Cuba, culture of Cuba, anything you like. So here's what the regulation actually says. That a general license is now available to any accredited U.S. institution of higher education. Accreditation is usually a regional thing, the Southeast Conference or whatever. So if you're accredited, you're in. You can be a two-year college. It doesn't matter as long as you're accredited. There's a general license to offer for all faculty and students, faculty including part-time or adjunct, meaning you can hire a instructor, characterize it as you will, a guest lecturer, a visiting professor, whatever it is, specifically for the purpose of doing a course in Cuba. The institution is licensed to pay him and to make all payments necessary to the course that's being offered in Cuba. You can offer it to any undergraduate student enrolled in a degree program at any accredited institution in the country. So if the University of San Francisco wants to do a program, it can take students from Stanford, UC Berkeley, or anywhere in the country. The one compliance point to keep in mind is that your institution has to designate a representative. You need to do that formally and have a letter in your file that Assistant Professor Smith or Dean Jones is the designated representative for all Cuban programs. And what they will do is on official letterhead, they will sign for anyone traveling to Cuba, someone to organize the course in Cuba. You can hire someone specifically to do that. You can send a professor. Anyone traveling for organizational teaching purposes, they have to have a letter saying that their travel to Cuba is part of a structured educational program. I'll go through this slower in a moment when I return to students. And stating that the individual is a member of the faculty or staff, including part-time or temporary staff, or is a student currently enrolled in a graduate degree program at an accredited U.S. academic institution, and that the study in Cuba will be accepted for credit toward that degree. So the critical point here is if you're Dean Jones and you're handing to student Brown a letter saying that he will show when he returns to the United States to customs or otherwise, you're giving him a letter saying he's authorized to go to Cuba, but you're certifying that you know two things about him or her. One is that he's enrolled in a degree program somewhere. He's going to have to demonstrate that to you because you're going to say that in the letter, and that his institution is going to award him credit for the study in Cuba, the program in Cuba. So those are two things you have to satisfy yourself to because you're certifying to that fact. And where the Treasury Department, who enforces all these programs, they do periodic spot audits of things like this. And they'll ask for all records, all people who've traveled to Cuba, and confirmation that they are in degree programs and so on. And again, violations of this will be treated if they're not, you know, in grotesquely in bad faith, if they're oversight or maladministration. They'll be dealt with as civil penalties, but they are heavy. So I would take that requirement seriously. So now a couple of terms here that no sooner had this been announced than I started getting calls from colleges asking me about hypothetically. And any of you who are involved with undergraduates know how fertile their imaginations can be in what they want to do in Cuba. So there were a lot of self-directed studies started popping up. Now, remember, this is not allowed, even under the general expansive academic travel now permitted. Transactions, everything the word used throughout the regulations are transactions. That means paying a Cuban national, a Cuban agency. Transactions related to activities that are primarily tourist-oriented, and this is the critical phase, including self-directed educational activities. Self-directed educational activities. So, now back to the reg. Your students are allowed to participate in a structured educational program in Cuba as part of a course offered for credit by the U.S. academic institution. So the critical word here is structured. And as usual, the government's given us no insight into what they mean. They rarely do. So at a minimum, it seems to me, so the hypotheticals that immediately started coming in is my student is enrolled in a History of South America semester course. She wants to spend 3 weeks in Cuba this summer and has said she will write a paper about Cuba on her return. And because she will receive credit for the History of Latin America course at her institution, does that count? I think the short answer is probably not. because it's not structured in Cuba. Keep in mind, you don't have to offer a exclusively Cuba program. So it doesn't have to be dance forms of Cuba for 2 weeks. It can be at your institution. It could be revolutionary movements in Latin America, 3-credit course. You take the students go to Cuba for a week, and their visit to Cuba counts toward that 3 credits. That's okay, too. But I would suggest that structured means a reasonable sort of, what is the word? It's not curriculum, but what do you call a structured lecture, tutorial, field trip sort of amalgam? Schedule, right, okay, that's right. Something like that. So you can show that for that 1 week program in Cuba as part of their history of Latin America, that they will visit various monuments that one of the subjects we'll get into later are guides and people like that you can retain in Cuba and how you'll coordinate your program. But something, there's got to be a spine in this, and there's got to be someone in a position of a teaching authority accompanying this group. Now, again, it can be adjunct, part-time. The government, they don't have to be a PhD or anything of the type. But do be prepared to show they have some expertise in the subject they're going to be teaching in Cuba. Now, how do you, at the high point of the academic programs until they were abolished, essentially abolished by a 10-week requirement, semester long, in 2004, reduced it to about 3 institutions carried on with Cuba programs. Now that we're back to the short courses again, there will be hundreds of institutions will, remember, they don't apply for a license this time, they'll begin to construct their programs. You need a counterpart in Cuba, a corresponding institution in Cuba. So far, there's only one, and that's the University of Havana. So any program of whatever duration, whatever subject matter, is limited to the University of Havana at the moment. We're hopeful that Cuba, there's an interministerial group meeting in Cuba that periodically considering where they're going with this. It includes the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Higher Education, some culture ministries. They may allow you greater flexibility in that, where you could have a correspondent relationship with the University at Santa Clara or Santiago, but so far, not. A little digression about Cuba and its attitude to academic programs. There were never much more than about 2,000, as I've said. I don't think Cuba probably wants very much more than that. It's just a guess. And I think they may continue to keep it in Havana in order to keep an eye on it. Cuba's going through a very unsettled period as they 20% of its workforce is being moved toward a nascent private sector. There's a lot of uncertainty. The Cuban government does not play games with its sense of what its internal security is. And it's only a private opinion that they don't want thousands of undergraduates running around Cuba. Those of you who have been to Havana may have noticed the distinctively uniformed blue police that patrol the areas that have most tourism in central Havana. They're there to keep young Cuban males out of central Havana. And the more undergraduates running around, and given our punitive drinking policies, domestically, they seem to turn all foreign travel into a protracted alcoholic binge. So they don't want young Cuban males, I think, integrating themselves into these groups. And when they had trouble in 1994 on the famous Malecon Boulevard, and it was during the context of the rafter crisis, it was young males that broke loose and started looting shops and things like that. I think they're going to probably keep a cap on it. So it's going to be competitive to get the University of Havana to approve your program. Aren't that many that are going to be approved? So put together strong applications, I would suggest, show an academic purpose in it that kind of allays fears that you're going to have unsupervised undergraduates running around Havana. But that's about the best. Now, I'll come back later to academic travel if you want to talk about professors, teaching at a Cuban institution. If any U.S. student is generally licensed to enroll in a Cuban university, but those are heavy programs. It's only at the University of Havana, Spanish medium, and Cuban Spanish to boot. You know, so they've got to be very strong linguistically. Not many do it. I think it's a dozen a year, maybe, study at the university. That is approved, too. So, again, and when we come to questions and answers, we can go through anything you want to talk about with academic travel, money, compliance, anything like that. So now people-to-people, the most promising. And this is the way the regulation reads, and it's identical to the Clinton regulation of 1999 that invented so-called people-to-people travel. And the history of that, again, because everything's political when it comes to Cuba. In 1999, our chief of mission in Cuba was a man named Michael Kosak, a very capable diplomat. He had negotiated the Panama Canal treaties in the Carter administration, career State Department man, started in legal advisor's office, was ambassador to Czechoslovakia during that country's transition out of the Eastern Bloc in the early 90s, late 80s. Kosak formed a view of the importance of cultural exchange and promoting political reform. Remember, everything is value-laden in this. When President Obama announced he was resurrecting academic and people-to-people travel, he didn't say that people-to-people travel is give a ringing affirmation of the value of cross-cultural exchanges to the American public or anything else. He said, in a continued effort to reach out to the Cuban people to support their desire to freely determine their country's future. All of that is code for democracy, a transition to democracy. So to the extent they've licensed people-to-people travel, it's meant to promote that end, democratization in Cuba. And that's what the Clinton administration was doing. Mike Kosak thought, from his experience in Czechoslovakia, remember, Kosak goes to Cuba expecting to, as an experienced man deeply experienced in these matters, to be presiding over a transition in Cuba. I think in those years we all thought it was going to look like East Germany. But, you know, the Cuban Revolution is a homegrown affair that has its own, you know, rhythms and permanencies. So Kosak found himself a lot of time on his hands and no transition happening. So he started thinking again about cultural. Remember, the first president of a democratic Czechoslovakia was the playwright, Václav Havel. Frank Zappa, I think, was appointed one of the first honorary members of culture, right, because of the band Plastic People of the Universe in Prague that had formed a focal point for so much dissatisfaction with the ossified bureaucratic structures of Czechoslovakia. So people to people. Get a lot of cultural exchanges going on and contribute to this ferment that may produce democratic change in Cuba. So that is why we have people-to-people travel in its origins and why we have it today. Whether we think that's a good thing or even a practical approach to Cuba is a separate question. So here's what they have to look like. Educational exchanges. You can drop the word exchange. It's not contemplated that there'll be reciprocal numbers of Cubans coming here. It's just surplusage. Don't worry about it. Not involving academic study pursuant to a degree program. So we can shorthand call this non-degree academic travel, or non-degree educational travel. When those exchanges, again, let's just call it non-degree, when that non-degree educational travel takes place under the auspices of an organization that sponsors and organizes such programs to promote people-to-people contact. So, the Commonwealth Club, would qualify for that. They do. The first thing I would say, the first criterion they're going to look for in your application is, do you have an educational mission? Is that part of what you do? The National Geographic has long had that, both within its magazines and its publications division and its lecture series and its television programming. The educational mission of the Commonwealth Club is, we're participating in an example of it this morning. So educational purpose, that can include an alumni society. It can include a music appreciation society. Hard to think. What it may not include is a bowling league, I suppose. But, you know, we could maybe artfully make a case even for that. But so some kind of educational dimension to what the group does. And then there, so we've got educational components. You're putting together, again, now these are specific licenses. It's not generally licensed. A license to the Office of Foreign Asset Control at the Treasury Department, there's no form. It's a letter. And it goes on your institution's letterhead. The regulation presupposes that you have some prior experience in doing this sort of thing, but I would suggest that's not going to be an iron bar. It does say an organization that sponsors and organizes. You might read that to say you have to have that pre-existing educational component to your organization, but I don't think it means that. I think if you create a mission statement for a new organization, invest in some nice-looking letterhead, and then write to the Office of Foreign Asset Control and say you're applying for a, if you want the full site, 31 CFR, that's Code of Federal Regulations, Section 515.565B2. I've got a handout I'll leave for you. You can, you don't have to. And say that you're applying for a people-to-people license. We don't know until the guidelines come out whether they're going to be multi-year. The old people-to-people were one-year multi-trip. You got the license, and then you put together your trips as you went along. As Elizabeth said, there's some talk that they may require a specific license for every trip you're planning, but I don't think they will. It's too burdensome. There are currently, by the way, four people at OFAC, four licensing officers handling all Cuban transactions. They're not looking to make more work for themselves, particularly now they're chasing Gaddafi's assets all over the world. So they're a little shorthanded. And, you know, the OFAC licensing officers always consider these Cuban travel programs to be beneath their dignity as economic warriors against terrorism and things like that. So, but what I'm telling groups to do today is submit your application, ask for a one-year license or a license of any other duration available. You want a license of people-to-people license for 1 year. To do multiple trips to Cuba, educational trips to Cuba. Bang, that's the first sentence. Then tell them who you are. Have available supporting materials that say that the Commonwealth Club was formed in 1903. Its mission statement. It is a, if you have any brochures, annual statements, then you include that sort of thing. All that's pretty much common sense, but you get to the heart of it. What I'm telling applicants to do today is submit a specimen itinerary for one trip to Cuba, and then say that it you certify it's representative of the cultural, educational itineraries that you will be following in Cuba. Break it into half days. So have a morning schedule, lunch, and an afternoon schedule. And you don't have to go hour by hour. Just you can say, now, keep in mind, touristic travel is prohibited by law, not just by these regulations, but by a peculiar law of 2000. Don't, and you'll be working with travel service providers in some cases. Try to avoid evening mojitos, you know, and visit the Tropicana, you know, a nightclub. You can do all of that. You can legally do all that. If you're in Cuba on a licensed basis, you're free in your spare time, which can be quite generous. You can go to the beach. You can go to any recreational venue you want to. But for your itinerary, show educational components. And Elizabeth and I have talked about this in detail, and we'll come back to it in questions. We've been advising, have a strong thematic core to what you're doing. Don't mix up too many different things. If you're a historical preservation society, try to stick to the preservation issues in Cuba, and that includes surveys of historical buildings. Cuba has a lot of newly self-employed people that are very well educated. In their English, you can find them. This is going to be a challenge for you, are good simultaneous interpreters into English. Sadly, given the economic circumstances of Cuba, I was talking to somebody the other day who said, my biggest problem right now is finding guides who speak English. And I said, well, there used to be quite a few of them. He said, well, they all married foreigners and they've left. You know? So a lot of them learned English so they could, you know, work in the tourist zone and leave Cuba. But they are there. So think about how you're going to find them. Give you some pointers later on that. And have them provide lectures. Have people, don't ever use the word tour, and don't talk about your tour director or anything like that. Talk about the educational director for the trip. And let's say that's John Smith, and he's an authority on Cuban percussion or something like that. That every day have an introductory lecture on whatever the theme of today's activity is going to be. Then arrange for visits to, for example, a fine art tour would take you to galleries, would take you to studios of private artists, would take you to museums in Cuba, that sort of thing. And just show what I'm saying now is morning visit studios, workshops, and fine art museums, and afternoon, you know, carry on with that sort of thing. You're going to need a Cuban partner at the other end. Historically, all of the American delegations went through Havana tour. We have, from Los Angeles, someone with a lot of experience.
Peter Sanchez.
Yeah, right.
No, I just said his name, Peter Sanchez.
Well, Peter Sanchez is here. Avail yourself of this resource at the break that we were talking earlier. Historically, all the American groups were fed through Havana tour. Is the course they have to? They're going to arrange your bus and meet you there and take you around and all. That's going to be your partner in Cuba. For a long time, it's been rumored that Havana tour is an aspect of the Ministry of the Interior, which is state security in Cuba. And it shows you the sensitivity to the U.S. dimension. Now there are new organizations in Cuba that are being allowed to handle incoming American groups, including San Cristobal and some others. That's not yet fully clear, but you'll need to make an arrangement with them. They can be good or bad in their attention to your program. Your programs are going to be as good as the time you put in to identifying and refining over time. First class guides, guest lecturers, and things like that. That's why you need a permanent lead into Cuba. It's the role that Elizabeth was playing for National Geographic. Someone that kind of anchors these programs develops them as they evolve, and then they become continuing programs. They can be very lucrative. Alumni societies, museums always found their Cuba programs were fully booked. And even during this recession, any trips to Cuba that have ever been approved have been oversubscribed. It remains exotic and people want to go. And the Cubans want this, unlike academic travel, because it's their absolutely idealized demographic. It's middle-aged couples, affluent, high cultural level, as the Cubans say. They spend money, and unlike many Europeans, they tip, right? So there is a good work-through into the economy of Americans, and Americans spend more money than anybody else. We have a bad reputation in some areas, but they love us in the service industries worldwide for that reason. So they're going to want these travelers, but they're going to want them to avoid political themes, obviously. If you want to jam yourself early on, start talking about meeting with dissidents and things like that. You know? And,
well, that'll probably get you through OFAC, though, won't it?
Well, as Elizabeth observed, it'll help you on the American end, but it'll kill you on the Cuban end. So let's get back on what we take one. Some of the things we were going to address. How are we doing for time?
Fine.
A little bit of time.
Travel service providers. They're worth a comment. The website that tells you about the government programs relating to Cuba, treasury.com, will get you there. Then look for, eventually try to, you'll get there, OFAC, O-F-A-C, Office of Foreign Asset Controls. Among the things that you'll find on that site are a list of certified licensed travel service providers, TSPs. If you have a people-to-people license, but none have been issued yet, but when they're issued, you're free to transact with Cubans. And a transaction is to book a hotel room, pay for a meal, pay a deposit on a tour bus. You can only do that if you have a people-to-people license. But travel service providers can do it. And if I do it, it would be illegal. If I called and booked you a room in Havana, it would be technically illegal. You have to go through a TSP, a travel service provider. And they can make those arrangements. On money, any program you structure is going to be limited to a $179 a day per diem. You'll find that on the OFAC website. And that's taken from State Department, and that's what they pay a that's what a Foreign Service officer is allowed in that particular country in terms of accommodation and meals. Cuba's $179. It could change at any point. But keep in mind how that works. The $179 per diem is only accommodation and meals for the most part, because when you're licensed to do something in Cuba, you're licensed, the per diem is subsumed in the license. You're free to do that. You're also free to make such additional expenditures that are directly incident, is the term, directly incident to whatever your purpose in Cuba is being. If it's educational programs, directly incident. That means paying the Cuban lecturer, renting the bus, paying the admission fee into the museum, let's see, what is that? If you rent a lecture hall, anything of that sort is directly incident. And you can now, if you're an educational institution, academic, you can have bank accounts in Cuba. And the money goes from, you can go to your bank, and they will make a third country transfer. Some of the corresponding banks are often Credit Leonay has been one of them. There's a Spanish bank, BB, Banco Bilbao or something. Anyway, they do a transfer to that bank. That bank does a transfer to your account in Cuba. So you no longer, it used to be burdensome that groups would travel with $100 bills because you can't use credit cards in Cuba. It's illegal. So your institution can now transfer money to Cuba. And that's where you'll pay for everything is probably out of that account. So the $179 a day will cover drinks, food, a taxi if you're going to the Tropicana, you know, at the end of the day, anything like that. You're allowed to bring back unlimited informational materials from Cuba, which is broadly construed to be any kind of publication, film, poster, fine art. But be careful with fine art for one reason, that we're in the peculiar Western tradition that makes a distinction between functionality and art. It bemuses the Japanese to this day. But fine art is an oil painting that hangs on a wall. Cuban, Afro-Cuban art is typically expressed in ornamentation of functional objects, drums, chairs, things like that, Yoruba themes. There's constant ongoing fights between art importers and customs over what is art. So if you're coming back with an elaborately carved Yoruba drum, you can expect some – I would make the argument it's art, but, you know, the customs officer is probably going to quarrel with you. Let me see – go through our checklist of things to – the Cuban end, we talked about that. It's they're still deciding how they're going to deal with all this. They may broaden. If people-to-people travel, they're waiting for the final guidelines to be published and applications. There are a lot of applications that have been filed by some preeminent cultural institutions in America are on file right now. The Cubans are waiting to see, understandably, what kind of licenses are going to be issued. And that will dictate how they start accommodating these groups. Keep in mind, they do want you. Unlike academic travel, I don't think they're going to put a ceiling on it. Right now, if you go to the best hotels in Cuba, you're stumbling over luggage from package tourists in the reception at the Hotel Nacional. It's a race to the bottom. They're competing. They have increasing Russian travelers now. And these are people on a winter's day in Central Europe are deciding between Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Cancun, Cuba, and it's cutthroat competition. They want U.S. travelers because they can actually rent that room at what they think is the realistic rate instead of a $50 mass discount. So they do want you, but they don't yet know how they're going to deal with it. I think what they'll do, in keeping with the new spirit of is they'll open up the tourist companies, Cubanacan, Gaviota, that handle real tourism into Cuba, and they'll unleash them on the American arrivals. They're hipper. They're more nimble. You know, they're rather than some of the old state security agencies that handled the Americans before. But we don't know that yet. When that becomes clear, we should think about something we might think about doing is setting up some kind of – Global Exchange has been very active over the years on this. We might consider some kind of data sharing network or information sharing so when these things are clarified, people can easily find out who they ought to be contacting in Cuba. But we'll find a way. Record keeping, anything you do with Cuba, keep a record for 6 years of it. Any expenditures, any agreements you have with a part-time lecturer or something, just think about OFAC the way you think about the IRS. Document it. It'll save you problems later. all of our federal agencies have been turned over to this kind of eat-what-you-kill mentality that that if they can fine you, you know, that goes into their general fund. So they're using civil penalties across the board now, asset forfeitures and so on, to fund the operations of agencies, and that's getting worse. So with these new budget cuts. So, by the way, we had a State Department speaker who was coming today that was going to talk about these programs. He couldn't come at the last minute because of budget constraints. You may have seen the State Department lost $800 million in this last go-round. So they're going to be more predatory than ever. Should I wind this up? Is there anything more I should say?
If you have anything else, otherwise we can wait for questions.
I think I can talk about religious travel if you want to or anything under the new guidelines, but I think we've covered it. Now it's probably best to get to specific inquiries that you might have. Christina, how do you want to do that?
I think we want to take a short break, let everybody, you know, use the restrooms, grab a drink, and then come back here for questions and discussions. I know that many of you have a TSP license. Many of you have organizations that are traveling to Cuba right now. We'd love to hear about your experiences, you know, and I think a lot of people here are interested in what your predictions are for when are these licenses going to be granted. Have you received any indication for how things might be changing? Because it feels like, I think for a lot of us, we're just in a holding pattern. And we're hoping to be able to move forward. How can we all move forward? So why don't we take a break, come back here at 11:15, and continue.